Now, just to remind you to tune in to John Breslin's Around the Northwest from Efficient Renewables. We talked about this earlier in the week. They're based at Unit 2, Main Street, Newtown, Conyngham. We're live there from 12 to 12:30, but there's a great day of information running all day. Informative talks run throughout the day about solar panel system, heat pumps, SEI, grants, financial options and commercial buildings that are looking to go carbon neutral. All new and existing customers today have the opportunity to win an amazing 10-panel solar system with inverter. There's tea, coffee and light bites there served throughout the day. There's an open invitation. They want you to come along and satisfy any curiosities you have or ask any questions about how you can maybe retrofit or if it's a new build or how you access SEIA grants. The credit unions will be there too to sort of highlight funding options as well. So just go along, no commitment, and also say hello to John and the crew. We're saying hello now to Councillor Martin McDermott. Good afternoon to you, or good morning to you, I beg your pardon, Martin. How are you keeping?
Good. Good morning, Greg.
Always great to have you on the show. Right, the housing agencies in the county this afternoon. What's the purpose of the visit, Martin?
It was not the housing agency. It's actually the senior officials from the Department of Housing.
Uh-huh, okay.
Anya Stapleton, Derek Rafferty and Neil Dalton, who are the three senior civil servants that look after the Defective Concrete Block Committee, are meeting us at 2 o'clock in Lifford today. It's a meeting that we've been trying to get. We did meet as a delegation from the Defective Concrete Block last December, and then we were to meet in March of this year. That meeting didn't happen, and I've been as chair trying to get them to come to the county for a while now to meet us and to go through the issues that we're having. So they've agreed to meet us today at 2 o'clock in Lifford, and there's a delegation from our Defective Concrete Block Committee meeting them. There's five or six councillors, the executive of the council, to go through the issues that we are, you know, the issues that we are coming across every day here with the Defective Concrete Block Committee. And I think it's important to be able to sit in front of the people that's really making the decisions and try and let them see the problems that we're having with some elements of the scheme.
What do you think the main points will be? Discussion points?
I think that one of the main points that we will certainly be discussing, I sent a letter to the Minister last week on behalf of the Defective Concrete Block Committee, asking him to make sure that the upgrade and cost is retrospective to all applicants that are in process of building as we speak, that not just the 10% cap, but also the SCSI figures that came out in March, that those figures would be retrospective as well, because we're now 6 months into a new year where those figures of 5% in March would probably be somewhere about 8% now. We've also asked...
Do you think you'll get any commitment in relation to that, Martin, or will they say again that, look, certain elements of this have been decided, but the fine print yet in terms of any retrospective aspects is yet to be determined, or will they come with news, I wonder?
Yeah, well, hopefully, like, I mean, at the end of the day, Greg, and the last day I was talking to you, I was saying to you that there is an issue in relation to legislation and wording that's in the Defective Concrete Block legislation that has to be changed. The wording will need to be changed before it'll be able to be retrospective. That's something that they have to do as officials, and that's what we will be, you know, having that with them today, seeing could they give us a timeline as to how quickly that can be turned around. The other issue that we sent was that we do feel at the minute that decisions in relation to options of 2 to 5, that those should be put on hold until the National Standards Authority release the update IS465, or at least release the preliminary investigations that they've done to IS465, so that would allow engineers to be making the right decisions. And we feel at the minute that, you know, some of the decisions that are being made, the outcome of that in the next couple of months could be detrimental to those decisions.
So for those who may not be aware, are you on about options whereby it's, you know, outer leaf sort of work rather than full demolition? So
exactly.
With those options, any option other than full demolition at this point, then, are you saying that to pause those decisions until we get the updated advice?
Yeah, I think the updated advice, you know, shouldn't be, it's within a few months. So at this particular juncture, I think we should be moving on the side of caution instead of, you know, giving people options that could have implications in a couple of months' time to the outcome of the update to IS-465.
Just in relation to that, it could be quite concerning because you would imagine that people in decision-making powers would have some knowledge of where we might go in terms of you know, the criteria. Yet we are seeing, and it triggered a protest there this week. We are seeing over at 1 in 3 original engineers' decisions in terms of full demolition being overturned. So I would love to know how those, you know, where we might be going with the recommendations and the decisions that are currently being made, how they all sort of operate in the same space, and what does that really mean for the future?
Yeah, well, look, I suppose, you know, there are lots of situations and lots of people that are getting options other than the option that their engineer would have put forward to the housing agency. We did have a long discussion with this with the housing agency at our defective concrete block committee meeting last Tuesday. I suppose from the housing agency's perspective, they have to work to IS-465 as it stands. We would have queries in relation to whether they're taking into consideration deleterious materials, which has already been sent by the department to both the local authority and to the housing agency.
So just in relation to that, for people who may not be aware, these are ministerial guidelines that state pyrrhotite, for example, should be included in any decisions vis-a-vis downgrading and what have you. What we really need to establish, do we not, is why the state's engineers seem to be only using IS-465 and not taking heed of the ministerial guidelines on the impact of pyrrhotite.
Yeah, that's correct. And the housing agency would say that they are, but then there would be contrary decisions made where, you know, I would have seen applications and seen engineers' reports that would have clearly demonstrated high levels of pyrrhotite, and those houses again are changed from option one to other options. So it's not clear at the minute as to what they're exactly doing, and that's something that we need to have a long conversation with these department officials about today and explain that, how that's happening and why that's happening, mm-hmm. because it's not fair on the families that are getting those downgrades at the minute. Mm-hmm. And you know, these are the officials at the end of the day, Greg, that are at the top of the ladder in the department. So
yes, indeed. The proposal on the table is, or they'll hear today, calls that to put a hold on options 2 to 5 until such time as we get IS-465 updated. Is there not an argument, Martin, that could be made to put all of the options on hold until such time as we get absolute clarity on foundations?
Yeah, there is, certainly.
Will that be articulated today?
That will be articulated today, but I suppose, you know, with the option of taking out your foundations, you know, people do have that option of taking them out. If they do get a full demolish, at least they have that option to do that. So
yeah, but that's at their own cost, is it not?
I know, yeah. Exactly. It's at their own cost. And when IS-465 is updated, hopefully that will alleviate that as well. But
so really, it would make no sense. It would make no sense to do full rebuilds on old foundations, yeah. But at the same time, look for a pausing of options 2 to 5, because inner blocks might be very likely to go over rising walls or indeed the foundations.
No, absolutely. But I suppose the problem that we have there is that at least people have the option to do that with their full demolition. People do need to get moving forward, and we can't completely stop everything. Just that's not going to happen. The scheme's not going to come to a complete standstill.
When you say we can't do that, why can't we? If we're not following the science, and some people, because they don't have the resources, are having to progress to rebuild in their entirety on potentially flawed foundations, mm-hmm. when we're talking about a multi-billion euro scheme that we might have to go back to again if the foundations deteriorate in any case, surely, especially given the conversation we're having nationally about how we spend public funding, surely we should at least consider if that should be an option to ensure
that is a conversation that we'll be having today with the senior civil servants to see what their opinion is of that and what their advice is from their engineers within the department, and what advice has been given, what work has been done by the National Standards Authority to date, what evidence have they got to date on IS-465, on the deleterious materials, on pyrotite, on all those issues. And
because I would be interested to ask one of the officials today. I would, just as a scenario, I would say to them, I would say, just for the peace of homeowners, if a homeowner cannot replace the foundations and they appear fine, a visual inspection feel fine, and they do a full rebuild on those foundations, and then those foundations begin to fail in 5 or 10 years' time, will they be able to re-enter that scheme to effectively probably toss the house again and replace the foundations? Mm-hmm. And if the answer to that is no, then I don't see how this scheme can progress until we have a definitive answer on the foundations, Martin. I say that, ask that question respectfully, of course.
Yeah, no, and it's a valid point, Greg, and that's what it's one of the points that we have actually on our agenda today to discuss with the officials. So hopefully we'll get some insight and guidance as to how we're going to proceed with all the options, not just options 2 to 5, but options 1 to 5. There are questions in relation to the science for every one of those options. But look, I think that, you know, hopefully within the next short period of time, I know Professor Dunlop has released some information this week that the National Standards Authority have as well. So hopefully within a short period of time, and again, maybe we'll get some guidance today as to what that timeline is for the National Standards Authority to give us their recommendations from the civil servants today.
Just a couple of questions. And if you don't have the answers, Martin, it's just say I can get back to you on that. That's fine as well, because you can't have every bit of information in your head. Could you ask Martin McDermott when the appeals committee might be up and running? We put in an appeal in January and we haven't even received receipt of the appeal yet.
Yeah, the appeals committee has been put in place. That's one of the agenda items today. The appeals process has been far too slow, Greg. There has been a chair appointed to the appeals process, but they haven't made any recommendations on any appeals to date. And again, that's one of the main, there's 14 main points that we're going to discuss today, and that's one of them, as to the timelines. And there needs to be exact and timelines that someone sends on an appeal, that it's 6 weeks turnaround or 8 weeks turnaround, whatever that may be. Yeah. At the minute, we don't have that information, but hopefully again today we'll be able to come back on and give that information, Greg.
Can you ask Councillor McDermott about the Department of Housing cancelling the working group on banking and mortgage-related issues after two meetings that achieved nothing? The central bank alluded to the need for joined-up thinking, yet the department has cancelled the forum that would allow for such joined-up thinking.
Yeah, well, again, the banking group done a lot of fantastic work there for a period of time when they were working with Brian Hayes from the Banking Federation, and they had a number of meetings with Engineers Ireland, with the department officials, and with the Department of Finance. Yeah, there was to be a meeting back, I think it was in April time, and that has been cancelled and that hasn't happened since. Again, we can take that up today with these department officials, but I suppose, you know, they done some great work up for a period of time, and I'm not so sure why that hasn't been kept on going. But again, we can ask the department that today as well. But I don't have the answer as to why the department hasn't had that meeting.
Yeah. And of course, and there's lots of stuff completely out of your control that you don't have answers to, and none of us have answers to. Be that as it may, we always do appreciate you coming on and fielding the questions, Martin. It's very, very much appreciated. So thank you very much indeed. And maybe we might get an update from that meeting at some point. Take care of yourself. Yeah.
Thank you, Greg. Right,
bye-bye. Take care. That's Councillor Martin McDermott there, who, as I say, there's a lot of questions that simply don't have answers, or the answers might seem unpalatable, but he's always there to take the call and answer as best as he can. 086 60 25000. We're joined on the programme now by David Coleman, a clinical psychologist. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Greg. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for joining us, sir. I really appreciate your time. And you're going to actually be speaking and on Green on Theatre in Letterkenny on Thursday, October 3rd at 8 p.m. And we'll talk more about what you'll be talking about on that. I often found when we talk about issues of mental health, and we try and talk about it a lot on this programme, there's different words like anxiety, mental health, and some people call it poor mental health, or there's lots of different phraseology, but there are a lot of them are broad terms, and anxiety is a very broad term, isn't it? Because anxiety is not necessarily a terrible thing.
Absolutely not. I think you're dead right. Anxiety is absolutely just a normal feeling, just like any other feeling, like happiness, sadness, embarrassment. You know, it's a feeling that'll come, and it's also a feeling that will go in most instances. And usually it's very situational, it's very specific to whatever the circumstances that you're in. And so I think one of the things that's happened, even though I'd agree it's great that there's been a greater focus on mental health over the last number of years, but one of the things that I think it has done is almost pathologized things like anxiety. And so I certainly in my clinic now have a lot of young people coming to me saying, you know, I have anxiety, yeah, almost like I have COVID or I have some kind of disease. And I'm not sure that's a really helpful way to think about anxiety. I think it's much more helpful to think about it just as yet another feeling, one that's, you know, probably quite helpful in certain situations.
Yeah, because we need another word. We're not going to get it, but probably another word for anxiety that is negative in your life and impacts on it. Like someone doesn't come in and say, I'm suffering from excitement, or I'm suffering from sadness, or I'm suffering from euphoria. But, you know, and I suppose we have to be responsible as to how we educate our children about things like anxiety and how to understand it, how you can quite easily control it in some cases.
Yeah, for sure. And it is all about the regulation of it. And I think that's where parents absolutely come in, because I think there's a lot that a parent can do to help their child understand both the experience of anxiety. So it might be something quite physical. They might have butterflies in their tummy. They might have tension. Their breathing might be off, whatever it might be. And so parents need to help kids recognize, well, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Once they recognize that they feel anxious in a situation, well, then they need to be able to regulate that anxiety. So I sometimes talk about it a little bit like an oven. You know, we don't get a choice about the oven being turned on or off. That happens because of the circumstances. But what we do get to regulate then is the temperature that we turn or allow the anxiety to get turned up to. And so I think that's the helpful bit for children, knowing that actually this is just a level of intensity of the feeling, and that you can bring that intensity down. And I think that is really, I think it's just empowering for kids to know that, because then they don't feel that they're a slave to anxiety. Rather, they feel like, okay, this is just something that I have to deal with. It's another challenge, but it's going to be a temporary challenge, and it's also probably one that I can regulate and manage.
But these are life learning skills that you bring into life, which is stressful, i.e. anxiety triggering exams, state exams, maybe going to third level, going for a job interview. We do have to learn, you know, what anxiety is and how we can control it. And, you know, a child might not tell you, I've got anxiety, but they can tell you they've got anxiety, because they might have trouble going to the toilet at times. They might have a pain in their belly. Mom, I've got a pain in my stomach. You know, we need to look out too when they can't verbalise what anxiety is, you know, how it may be manifesting, and then start working on some of the stuff you're talking about.
Exactly. And I think the most common thing that children and teenagers certainly will do if they feel anxious is they'll want to avoid the situation. So that's often the biggest indicator for a parent. You know, once your child gets to the point of saying, I don't want to go, don't make me go, or they get really upset at the thought of going, that's probably an indicator that they're nervous about some element of whatever it is. So whether that be going to school, maybe it's about going to football training, maybe it's about going to the drama group, maybe it's just about meeting up with their friends, whatever it might be. And so I think when we get those signs or signals from our children, again, it's about a parent not panicking themselves, about not going, oh my God, they're anxious, that means, you know, they've got this debilitating illness that's going to be there forever. Rather, it's about a parent going, okay, yeah, it makes sense that you're feeling anxious now, and I think you're probably anxious about A, B, or C. Here's what we can do about A, B, or C. But also, even when you're feeling anxious, I think you're still going to be able to cope. And here's what you can do to feel a little bit less anxious. Here's what you can do when you get there. And here's how I think you're going to feel at the end of it. And I think you're going to feel really proud of yourself that you know, even though you felt a bit anxious, that you gave it a go.
Yeah, and I think that's the function of Thursday, October 3rd. You tool parents and guardians with the language and the knowledge to do that. I know it's not specifically an anxiety, but I just do find it quite interesting that I think we A lot of the time, what we do is we accept if a child says, I'm feeling anxious, and then we say, my child suffers from anxiety, and that's the default. And life then is designed around, I have an anxious child, and then the parents become involved in that avoidance, right? I'm not sure if that's correct or incorrect. But I also wonder sometimes, David, if low mood, we have the same problem with low moods that very quickly becomes described as depression, and my child is suffering from depression. And this is no way to take away people that are genuinely suffering from anxiety and depression. Mm. That's a fact, right? But do you think maybe low mood can kind of sometimes be in that same space that we accept it, that is the reality, and then move forward with my child suffers from depression?
So I think you're dead right. It is difficult sometimes to differentiate between something that might be problematic and a disorder and something that is actually just a natural, normal response to circumstance. And I think for myself, I sometimes, and even when I'm talking to children or teenagers, I'll talk about things like depression with a small d and depression with a big D. And so depression with a big D might be something that is a clinical depression that is, you know, maybe has kind of biological origins or genetic component to it, that it's running in a family, or that might be what we would classically consider as part of a mental illness. And so, you know, that does happen. There are people who experience depression like that, but for most of us, we experience situations that leave us feeling somewhat depressed in our mood, that we just don't feel good, we just don't feel happy, we don't feel hopeful, we don't see how things are going to change in a positive way. And I think it is helpful for us though to see that that is so situational, and that there might be things that we can do to help ourselves so that we don't have to feel that low mood, that we can actually do some positive things. Because, you know, one of the things I'll be talking about in the talk next Thursday is about how, you know, sometimes when we change our behavior, it has this positive knock-on effect on how we feel. If we can change our thinking, it can have a positive knock-on effect on how we feel. And so I think there are ways that we can address the feeling without necessarily just engaging in some kind of, you know, long-term talk therapy about the feeling, but that actually just by doing things, by changing the way that we think, changing what we do, repairing some aspect of our physical selves, it can just give us that boost that allows us to feel differently, and then the whole thing can begin to move in a positive direction as well.
Yeah, and you know, we are fearful now, many of us as parents too, in that we go to the worst case scenario if a child is anxious or depressed with a little d, for an example. We fear that they might self-harm, or they... Now, this is not to sort of say that that is not a risk, and it depends on the individual child, but I think sometimes that fear, I think sometimes that fear consumes us so that we instantly treat what the worst thing it could be, rather than sort of maybe looking at some simple solutions that might help.
For sure. I think catastrophic thinking is definitely one of those maladaptive thinking strategies that we can have.
And it does make life a lot more... A wonderful part of proper anxiety as well.
Because you're right. If we jump to the worst case scenario, we assume the worst, and we assume that, you know, something that is, perhaps short term, you know, temporary, manageable, is actually something, you know, much more dangerous and long term and debilitating. And I think you're dead right. It isn't helpful for parents to go straight from 0 to 100 themselves in terms of their own concern about their child. If their child is upset about something, if their child is worried about something, these are normal feelings. And so we have to respond to them as normal feelings for as long as we can, until there's some really clear evidence that this has gone way beyond it. And I think then, for sure, you know, there might be other things that we might need to do. We might need to contact some professionals, maybe to give some support. But for the most, you know, in most situations, the majority of people and the majority of kids and teenagers, they feel anxious and they just need adult support to feel less anxious. Then they can go about their daily business.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that avoidance thing you talk of is really, really important, because I've tried to articulate this before, but it is your brain or some part of you trying to protect you from a situation, and it's that battle. But you know, your brain saying, no, we can't do this, Greg, because you know how this makes us feel, and if we stay here in the bedroom, we're happy and safe, and that's not helpful either. Do you find in your presentations, David, there's light bulb moments or all of a sudden, you know, a scenario at home, it's like, oh, right, now I see what it is? Or sort of behavior in a child that the parent goes, right, I recognize that now, that makes sense, and now I can use some of the stuff you're going to say to go home and start working on that?
I definitely think, certainly the way I approach giving any kind of public talks, it is all about giving people those kind of light bulb moments where they can see the parallel between some of the things that I'm talking about and their own experience, which allows them then to begin, hopefully, to think about their own experience differently. And so maybe they will think differently about their child's worries. Maybe they will feel empowered themselves that it's, now rather than feeling helpless when their child says that they're anxious, they feel like, okay, I have a really good strategy now. I know what I'm going to do. And I think some of the skills and how I present those skills, I think, make it possible for people as well to feel like, okay, this is very actionable. I can do this. This is not rocket science.
Yeah, because there's a generation of, and not all, but there's a generation of parents now, maybe 40, 45 or 35 themselves, who maybe walk around with anxiety and never really dealt with it. And they're nothing, they care more about their child, and they're 13 or 14, and they start saying to the parents that, I'm feeling anxious. The next thing, mum and dad's climbing up the wall because it's triggered their anxiety, and that helps nobody, does it?
For sure. And I think, once a parent becomes anxious or if they start to panic about a situation, it's only going to exacerbate a child's anxiety. So for sure, it's up to us to regulate some of our emotion. Greg, I'm going to have to apologize. I can hear my doorbell ringing, which means my 11:30 client has arrived.
And we shall not interfere in that. What I'll do is I'll let you go and do that. And what I'll do, David, is I'll recap how people can go and see you. Take care of yourself.
Great. Thanks very much. And hopefully we'll see some of the folks up at Ungreen on next Thursday.
Indeed. Okay. So that's David Coleman, a clinical psychologist whose 11:30 has just arrived. And he is having a presentation at Ungreen on Theatre Letterkenny on Thursday, October 3rd. It's at 8 p.m. He's going to focus on understanding how anxiety affects our children, teenagers and families, and will give concrete and practical tips, he assures us, for how to help children deal with the stresses and pressures in their lives, which are there. All the while, it's how we deal with them often. But then, of course, there are other cases that fall under the same umbrella of words, whereby, obviously it requires interventions and supports on a higher level, if that makes sense. So his presentation lasts about an hour, and then there's a Q&A with the audience in attendance. Check out the box office at Ungreen on Theatre for more. You're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. What I'm going to do now is welcome our next two guests, Leanne Quigley, who's chairperson of the Irish Deaf Society. And my conversation with Leanne is going to be assisted by Catherine White, who's an Irish Sign Language interpreter. So both of you, good morning. Leanne, it's very nice to have you on the programme. Thank you so much for joining us. Right, so Irish Sign Language Awareness Week 2024 is running until the 29th of September. Leanne, why is this such an important week?
Thank you for being invited here. This week is a very special week. It is a big calendar event for the deaf community in Ireland and worldwide. It's the International Week of Deaf People, and it was established by the World Federation of the Deaf with the aim of promoting and increasing awareness of the existence of deaf people throughout the world. So that's worldwide. And in Ireland, we are having our own Irish Sign Language Awareness Week, and that is about improving the awareness of the existence of Irish Sign Language and deaf people by campaigning, promoting, and all of that. And over the past few years, we have been gaining momentum very slowly, very surely, very positively. And every day this week, we are focusing on themes such as advocacy, deaf culture, inclusive education. The list goes on.
What do we need to be doing as a society to ensure that the deaf people of Ireland have full access, that they can participate equally in all aspects of society? Why shouldn't they be able to?
Irish Sign Language was officially recognised back in December 2017, so it's now legal. And we ask of each organisation, service provider, to support the Irish Sign Language Act of 2017 and its implementation. Now, the National Disability Authority report of 2020 said that the majority of governments were unaware of its existence. So for you, the listeners today, look up the Irish Sign Language Act 2017 You can find the information on the Irish Deaf Society website if you want to learn Irish Sign Language, Deaf Awareness Training, Sign Language Classes, and all of that can be provided to you. So it's more about the listeners providing support. There is also the Irish Sign Language Charter that we have developed, and we're asking organisations and service providers to support this particular charter in promoting the inclusion of deaf people, having access to information, any public body making announcements, ensuring that there's accessible information in that way. So it's up to all of you, the listeners, to support the Irish Deaf Society, to be involved and for us to be included.
Yes, because often in assisting people, we wonder, what can we do? Simply offer support and back campaigns and what have you. I just want to ask about Irish Sign Language, because perhaps some would argue, not unlike the spoken language, it can be a little bit more complex and different to other language. So talk to me a little bit about Irish Sign Language, its complexities, and even how there are gender differences within the language, please, Leanne.
Irish Sign Language is a language in its own right, separate from the spoken language. We have our own grammar. We use physical movement within our language, and within us, there are gender-based sign language, but that's a historical part of where deaf girls and deaf boys were segregated in their education. There are also regional variations. Now, I am based in Dublin. Anyone in Donegal or other parts of the country, there will be regional accents. You know, just you have in spoken language, we have that same thing as well. Irish Sign Language belongs to Ireland. It doesn't follow the spoken language. But when we say Irish Sign Language, it's because it belongs to Ireland. It has developed over the generations. It has naturally evolved, and over the decades, obviously, like the spoken language, sign language would have made those changes as well. So we experience that sameness. Now, in the UK, they speak English. We also speak English as well. Over there, they say British Sign Language. Here we say Irish Sign Language. And those two sign languages are completely different. Now, in Ireland, we have, for the alphabet, we do it on the one hand. So it's the one-handed alphabet. Over in England, it's the two-handed alphabet. And each country will have its own variations as well.
There are 5,000 deaf people in Ireland who use Irish Sign Language, if I'm correct in that, and very proud to do so, and would see its use and its existence and presumably its support and recognition as very important as a linguistic and, you know, cultural, or they would see themselves as a linguistic and cultural minority group, as opposed to being disabled.
Yes. Yes, that would be right. We, the deaf community, are incredibly proud of our language. Now, society at large, once we're within that, we do face barriers. It's not because we can't hear, it's the language barrier, but we are proud to be a linguistic cultural minority. And you're right in saying there's around about 5,000 deaf people. We estimate maybe 5,000 to 7,000 that deaf people use as the primary language. But we also have to consider the family members, the professionals that work within the deaf community. So we estimate around about 40,000 people use sign language in Ireland. And we advocate that that number increase. Anyone can learn how to sign. It is not just for the deaf population. And for those children that want to learn sign language at a young age, it causes more fluidity, it ensures more inclusion, it includes more opportunity. So it's estimated around about 40,000. There's been no research done to cite the exact number.
Many of us would like to have some basic sign language, so that if we encounter someone who is deaf, that we can at least, you know, politely say good morning or good afternoon or ask how you are. And I just note today that two deaf students have launched a campaign for Irish Sign Language to be made a Leaving Cert subject, saying the current system puts them at a disadvantage in the third level points race. And I can understand that, but I think it would also assist the many other students who have hearing to be able to, you know, communicate with those who do not. Because the one figure I don't have, and I think it would be quite large, is how many of the wider population would like to be able to at least have some basic communication skills using Irish Sign Language, Leanne.
With these two particular students campaigning for ISL has a Leaving Cert, we commend them. Deaf students are clearly marginalised from deaf education. We campaign within the education sector for inclusive education, but the students are clearly saying they do not feel included within education. We, the Irish Deaf Society and its supporters, believe that ISL should be placed on the curriculum, not just for deaf students, but for anyone that wishes to learn Irish Sign Language. And in the long term, that adds to us being more included within society. Now, the Department of Education launched the title, I think, Yes to Modular Sign Languages. Now, for primary school, let's say, for example, there is a six-week sign language course amongst other languages. Now, ISL is one of the top five languages that primary children want to learn for a six-week period. That shows the interest. It's a basic six-week course, and that causes me to just be incredibly excited for it. Now, very randomly, I went into a coffee shop one day, and I was so used to gesturing and writing, and the person behind the counter said, "Can I help you in sign? Do you want coffee?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Thank you." It absolutely made my day. Something small can create somebody's day, and such a good day for me.
We stream this program on YouTube and Facebook daily. We've been doing it for a number of years, and my principal motivation for that was the fact that it's subtitled. The subtitles aren't perfect, but what it means is that people who have hard of hearing or who are deaf or however they wish to describe themselves can keep up to date with news from their local radio station or keep abreast of current affairs conversations that are happening that you can't necessarily get in a newspaper. And we've had a fantastic reaction to that. So I'm particularly pleased for the first time that I've been able to speak to you, Leanne Quigley, you able to use your Irish Sign Language with the assistance of our mutual friend now, Catherine, because I think it's always about doing as much as we can to see everyone and every disability or not that they might have, but also to actively try and do things to make life more inclusive, because words are cheap. So I've really enjoyed this, and I feel we've pushed a bit of a barrier, and I'm really, really pleased to have been a part of it.
And I want to thank you for creating this kind of inclusive opportunity. And deaf people will now see sign language in action. So to see sign language in action on a radio station, because radio interviews that have been done in the past did not have that Zoom facility. And it would happen with an interpreter on the phone, and that would relay that information. That in itself was a barrier for deaf people because they wouldn't hear the radio station. So I like the fact that you're creating an example of good practice here. And we hope that more local radios will take this on board, because now you have shown us it is online. The language is visual. It can be seen. So I want to thank you for giving us this opportunity, especially during our International Sign Language Week.
And other than it having a theme, which is very important, there's an awful lot going on. The IDS and other deaf organisations have a range of activities planned to recognise and celebrate this week. There is a whole host of them, I think, quite importantly, Deaf Career Day, cultural events and content celebrating diversity in the deaf community. All of this can be accessed in one simple place online, irishdeafsociety.ie, and you can find out much more about IDS and all of the events and campaigns, and be a you know, be a friend, be an advocate, support them by signing up to whatever campaigns you may find there. But for now, unless there's something you want to wrap up by saying, Leanne, I want to thank you, Leanne Quigley, Chair of the Irish Deaf Society, for joining us today. And also, of course, a big thank you to Catherine White, who's assisted as our Irish Sign Language / English interpreter.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
Bye-bye, ladies. Thank you so very much for your time. It was lovely having you on the programme, and you can watch that back, of course, whenever you wish, on our YouTube channels, our Facebook channels, and what have you. Slán, thank you so very much indeed. A few minutes to give a plug to an event that's taking place as part of Recovery Month, and the event is taking place in the Clannery on Friday. It's called Building Recovery Together. Together, Recovery, Diversity and Inclusion. It runs from 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Paula Leonard is CEO of Alcohol Forum Ireland and is welcome back onto the programme. Hiya, Paula.
How are you doing, Greg?
Right. How do you frame recovery? I suppose recovery can be day one, you know, day 10,001. It's all individual to the individual, isn't it?
Absolutely. We have some people coming tomorrow that are celebrating, you know, 10 years of recovery. Those early days of recovery can be quite tricky for people, or you may go through particular stressful time in your life where it's difficult to prevent relapsing. So it's important to have recovery communities that support each other, that are peer-led, and they are emerging everywhere. We've had an amazing month of activities right across Ireland with recovery cycles, boxing events, festivals, comedy festivals, and in Donegal tomorrow, I suppose I was just listening to your previous speakers and, you know, I am very conscious that there is hidden harm in relation to alcohol in the deaf community. I've had people in the deaf community in Donegal raise that issue with me. Unfortunately, probably because the week that's in it, we don't have a sign language interpreter for tomorrow. I couldn't get one. We do have a lady speaking from the deaf or from the blind community who's talking about her experiences of recovery and the additional risks and stresses that there are for people in the blind community. We have some people talking who are in recovery themselves. But really, tomorrow was about saying that recovery is for everybody. The different sections of our community may have different barriers to accessing services. They could be about language. They could be about accessibility. They could be about higher levels of poverty or social exclusion. And we have people from the Palestinian community, the African community, the traveller community, including Senator Eileen Flynn, coming tomorrow to talk about that and say that, you know, if you cannot see it, you cannot be it. And we need to have champions for recovery right across our population. Donegal has a really diverse population now. And we need to ensure good access to services, good language supports. We need to talk about inclusion for people who have disabilities. For example, at a national level, we don't know what the picture is because we don't collect data on the number of people with disabilities who access addiction services. So all of that will be in the mix tomorrow, Greg, and I'll be chairing a bit of it, but I'm not speaking. We have a really amazing lineup of speakers, really brave people who are raising issues in their community and who are talking about their own recovery journeys. And
yeah, and there's different stages, isn't there? There are, you know, where there are gaps, where there are supports and how you can access them. It's how we can improve access. And there's stories of hope as well, because for people sometimes maybe who are struggling in their recovery or at the early signs of it, the road looks a very, very long way away, and maybe it might be encouraging to hear other people's stories. They're further down their journey, you know, to offer some hope and maybe that little bit of support or boost that they might need at that time.
Yeah, I think that's really it. It is about creating a recovery movement that's visible, that gives that sort of inspiration, that gives that support, that is peer-led, and that's celebratory, you know, that really acknowledges getting into recovery is really difficult. It's really challenging, but it can be really rewarding. And lots of people in recovery want to give back and support people who are on the same journey. And tomorrow's a bit about celebrating, but also acknowledging that, you know, we lose 4 people a day, every day in this country as a result of alcohol. And we've got the highest numbers of drug-related deaths in Europe per head of population. So, you know, our to-do list is long.
We face some great challenges, especially with the emergence of new drugs and how people are taking them and taking 2 drugs at the same time and what have you. Everybody is welcome tomorrow between 9:30 and 1 p.m. As Paula outlined, representatives there from all different types of groups, Irish, travellers, African, Palestinian, Polish communities, and it's about, you know, what's there, what should be there, and hope as well. I think that sums it up. And as I say, 9:30 tomorrow at the Clanree. You've a great lineup, so I think it's going to be a great event, Paula.
We have a fantastic lineup. So as I said earlier, I'll be doing more listening and less talking tomorrow because we have great speakers. We have Barbara is coming from the Polish Alcohol Service in Dublin. They actually have people from Donegal who access their supports online. So just sharing those messages of hope and of services and the fact that help is out there and it does exist.
Wonderful stuff as always, Paula. Thank you so much for your time. Paula Leonard there, CEO of Alcohol Forum Ireland. We're back with you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Don't go anywhere. Most of you don't. Coming up after the break, John Breslin is around the Northwest live from Efficient Renewables. That's in Newtown, Cunningham. You can call in and say hello. They've got information talks, information on solar panels, heating systems, grants that are available, other funding options and what have you. And you could even win a 10 panel solar system with inverter. John Breslin has all the details and the usual crack and music coming up after we take a break for the news. Have a wonderful Thursday, everyone.